So good evening and welcome to this talk on developing the peaceful heart. In the little flyer that we put together for tonight, I think I was kind of not directly quoting, but citing some teachings that I've received from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, where he says that this whole topic of dealing with the world around us and war and other issues, how we can look at this idea of outer disarmament, you know, that we need to take away all the things that cause all these problems on an external level. And certainly that's, you know, one step, but everything begins with what he calls inner disarmament, which is developing peace of mind and inner peace that will help us to create the causes for outer peace as well. There's a wonderful quote by the Buddha, actually, from one of the sutras, where he says, "There is no higher happiness than peace." So when we talk about this word peace, obviously peace has a bit of a romanticized idea in the West. We have this vision of, you know, what peace might look like, and oftentimes, it's a projection on what the outer world looks like. And there's nothing wrong with that, because the outer world certainly will be a manifestation of what's going on the inside. But at some level, we have to acknowledge that it really does start internally in terms of our own minds and what we're doing in the world around us to create the causes for peace. Lama Yeshe himself said, if you expect life to be up and down, your mind will be much more peaceful. So we see, to some extent, the external world is going to be the external world, and we're going to have to deal with, you know, conflicts and wars and countries invading countries and people, you know, having violence in the streets and riots and what have you. I mean, this sort of thing exists in the world that we live in, and it probably will be quite a long time until we've gotten rid of all of that. But what can we do in the meantime? Learn how to work with our minds, with the ups and downs, the difficulties, the challenges of life, in order to develop peace, so that we aren't really tormented more than what we need be. There's another sutra of the Buddha. I'm not going to do too many other quotes from these other books for a little while, but there's a sutra of the Buddha where he talks about this idea. I call it the second arrow. He basically says that there are sort of two arrows that we end up getting hit by. And the first one, we don't have much control over, because this is the suffering of experiencing what's going on in our world. And so it can be, for some of us, the agitation of, you know, not getting things our way at work or while we're driving a car or what have you. Or it can be the bigger issues, you know, war and, conflict, things that go on that make our lives a little unstable and difficult, or even, you know, financial challenges, things that occur in the world that we don't have a lot of control over. So that's the first arrow. We might refer to that kind of as pain, and it can be both the mental pain of having to experience those, as well as the physical pain of that, you know, whatever it might be that's happening to us. But then we have a second arrow that we have a lot of control over, and this is our tendency to have these afflictive states of mind arise when we experience these things. So normally when we experience something that doesn't go our way, where we would like a different result, then we get really frustrated and we often get angry at the situation, or we do things that, you know, are irrational at the moment, simply because we've let ourselves get hit by that second arrow. So this is a way of kind of beginning to identify that at some level the Buddha was telling us that we do have a choice in the moment of how we are going to work with whatever it is that life throws at us, whatever those first arrows are. Because as we can see, we all have things in our life that we find quite challenging. So how we work with those things is this, you know, second arrow that we need to avoid, because most of, you know, the first arrow is pretty much inevitable. You know, how do we deal with conflict, distress, difficulty in our life? This is really the subject of what I'd like to spend tonight talking on. I do have to give a whole lot of credit to a wonderful little book written by Joseph Goldstein that has two essays in it, and one of them is on the subject of a heart full of peace, is what he calls it. And I'm going to quote quite a bit from this, because I think he's got some really nice ideas in there. Joseph Goldstein is actually a Vipassana practitioner. He's quite involved with Insight Meditation Society. But he's got his fingers on the pulse of all forms of Buddhism. I think he's had a lot of Tibetan teachers as well. So a lot of what he talks about in here is actually very similar to our tradition. So I feel like it's quite a reliable source to work with. He relates the story of someone whose name is Dr. Tenzin Chodok. Tenzin Chodok was a Tibetan who lived in occupied Tibet for quite a while. I guess he's escaped from Tibet sometime in the recent past. He was apparently, according to what Joseph Goldstein says, imprisoned in Tibet for 21 years. And they said for a good 17 of those, at least, he was in situations where daily he was being beaten, you know, tormented by his captors and so on. And there's many of these stories, you know, of like people who've come out of Tibet and recounted the horrors of being imprisoned by the Chinese for whatever they were doing. And it doesn't go into the detail of what he did that ended up in, made him end up in prison. But, you know, the physical and psychological stress that you would be under for so many years of being in prison, you would think would make someone into a pretty angry person. But of course, as we hear in many of these stories, he used it as an opportunity to practice. And in doing that, came away from it with some really valuable lessons that have been culled down by Joseph Goldstein into what he would call 4 points of understanding in times of distress. And I really like these, and these are kind of the springboard for what we're going to discuss for the rest of this evening. So I'd like to go ahead and put them up on the board one at a time, and we can talk about each one of them, because I think they're really quite nicely set out. Maybe I'll turn on the light now. So the very first one that kind of helps us to deal with distress and to develop this peaceful heart is, these are words from Joseph Goldstein's book. He says, we must endeavor to see every situation in a larger context. You know, I recall another talk that the Dalai Lama gave where, I think it's actually on tape now, it was a talk that he gave in London right around the end of 1999, before the new millennium, and it's a talk called Ethics for the New Millennium. And he was using this example of like when this is your scope, you know, this little hole, then, you know, anything that gets in the way, however small it is, seems really big because it covers the whole thing. Whereas if your scope is much bigger, then, you know, my finger is quite small in the scope of a larger picture. And this is something that obviously is relating to how we're framing every situation in terms of a very narrow focus of me, myself, and I, and whatever is going on, and not seeing it within the context of what is this all about? What is this whole situation about? What is the other person's point of view? How am I to reframe this situation to be able to make it into an opportunity to work with my mind? All these sorts of things are what is meant by kind of seeing it in a larger context. You know, when we have a very narrow view that's really just me, my needs, my having to have everything my way, then just the smallest tweak of that causes us a lot of pain and anguish. But if we're looking at it from a bigger perspective, then we have an opportunity to do something really worthwhile with it. So, for example, what was going on with this doctor, you know, with Dr. Tenzin Chodok? He basically was looking at this as an opportunity to try to see his enemy, what was appearing as an enemy, which is somebody, you know, the prison guards, what have you, that were torturing him, beating him, and so on, to try to see that as an opportunity to learn, to almost look at his captors as his teachers. And this is something that we wouldn't normally think of doing. You know, our normal response would be to fight back, to get angry at people who are beating us, to do something because of the perceived injustice of what was happening. Now, to some extent, we can say that a portion of this reframing in the bigger picture can also be done with an understanding of karma. And, you know, tonight's teaching isn't strictly about karma, But it's hard to talk about Buddhism sometimes without talking about karma. Even when we were doing the motivation tonight, when I was talking about kind of your intention having a strong impact on the results that you get, this is really what karma is all about, is the use of our mind so that we can then create the results that we want to experience. Well, when we are experiencing results that are unfavorable, that aren't really so pleasant to endure, then we have to examine where did those results come from. If there's a principle right now that if I use my mind in a positive way, I get a positive result in the future, if I use it in a negative way, I get a negative result in the future, then obviously anything that's ripening right now in terms of my experience, I created the causes for previously. I know this, you know, it's a bit of a hard concept to think that everything that we experience is in some way conditioned and a product of our past actions. But in some ways this should be actually quite liberating, because it means that there isn't some force out there that's punishing us in any way. Karma is simply a natural law. You plant particular seeds, you get those particular, you know, results from those seeds. So in some sense, I find it personally quite reassuring that we have this law of karma. But when we do have things happening to us that are difficult, there is a tendency to blame the other person, to look at the other person and make it their fault. With this principle of karma, we see that we're a part of the picture too. You know, that we are an active participant in this action coming to this fruition. You know, our past actions ripening into something that is happening to us now. So no doubt this doctor, when he was in prison in Tibet, was also doing a similar thing. Because of his knowledge of karma, he was understanding that for whatever reasons in the past, through his own ignorance and blindness to, you know, the effects of his actions, he must have engaged in actions that ripened into him being tortured in a Chinese prison. You know, this whole teaching on karma isn't there to make you feel bad about yourself. It's there to make you feel actually quite empowered to then try to learn the lesson from whatever it is that you're having to experience, or to use it in some way to work with your mind, to work with developing your mind. The way that Joseph Goldstein talks about this I found kind of interesting too, because he doesn't bring up karma quite as much there. He does in other places of his little essay on this topic. But the idea that there's sort of an opportunity, he calls it a greatness of heart, and I really kind of like this idea, that when we are having distress in our lives, whatever that might look like, you know, we're reacting to what our country is doing in another country halfway around the world, or we're reacting to things that are much closer in our lives, things that people say to us, you know, at work, in our families, what have you, that there's an opportunity there, kind of a greatness of heart in times of distress. And we need to try to kind of find that opportunity. It's almost a bit of a game. Pema Chodron calls it kind of like life giving us the lessons we need to learn. You know, whenever we have something in our lives, what is it that we need to learn, and how do we go about that process of finding out what that is? If we follow our habitual tendencies, which are to get angry back, you know, to have a very angry and agitated mind, we know that we've done this many times in the past, and we can analyze it and see if that really has made a difference. Chances are it hasn't. Chances are it's only been, you know, much more futile and really just thrown fuel in the flames of the anger of the other person as well as our own. And there's really no solution there. But if we, you know, examine what is it that we could learn from this situation, like this doctor took this as an opportunity to learn compassion, to learn loving kindness towards those people who are, you know, torturing him, to really feel an understanding of their situation. And this is what's leading into sort of his second point, because this is really the fundamental thing that I'm assuming that he worked with while he was trying to undergo all these various levels of torture and suffering. And that's kind of reframing who this person is that is causing us distress. So right now we have a tendency of seeing them as what we call enemies. But again, in quoting Joseph Goldstein from his book, he said, we must see our enemies And then he also says, or the difficult people in our lives, you know, so we don't have to, this word enemy is a pretty strong word, but anyone or any situation that is difficult in our lives that involves other beings. As human beings, like ourselves, or I'll just put like myself for each of us to kind of, you know, work with. So when we say we must see our enemies as human beings like myself, we could expand on this and say even sentient beings as like myself. You know, the whole idea, the Buddha says that basically any being that has consciousness, whether we're, you know, in this realm we have animals and human beings, and there are said to be many other realms where beings exist, but all beings kind of in a similar light. And what does it mean to see them all as human beings? You know, the commonality of our condition of being in cyclic existence, being in this state of existence that is primarily dealing with these complications of our own deluded states of mind, our own afflictions, the karma that arises from those, all the actions we engage in, and then kind of being controlled by all of that. So when we examine it, we see that, you know, really this person who, let's use an example of, again, somebody in our lives that's maybe yelling at us for something that we didn't do, you know, so this is a case where we know we didn't do whatever it is that they're yelling at us for, but they're getting quite angry at us. You know, and there's a tendency in those situations to be really quite adamant and almost really even more angry because somebody's accusing you falsely of something that you didn't do. But if we look at that, we can see that that person who is being difficult at that time is under the control of their delusions in the same way that we are, under the control of their karma, having to wrestle with a mind that can get quite angry, a mind that can get agitated, a mind that can get belligerent, and so on. So why do we hold them in such a different light? Why do we think that for some reason they're supposed to control their minds, when we know from our own experience that we don't have a very good track record of controlling our own minds? So at some level, when we begin to understand this commonality, that these beings are just like us in wrestling with these states of mind and creating the causes for their own suffering, if anything, it should begin to open us to compassion. I mean, this is another story that was very similar to this of Kyabje Rigpa Rinpoche, who actually we have a picture of. He's the second picture from the left on the top up there. He died almost 3 years ago now, and he was also imprisoned in Tibet and managed to escape after quite a bit of time in Chinese prisons. And he would talk about how he used it as an opportunity to really open his heart to the suffering that these guards were going to experience because of their actions, because they were under the control of the delusions and, you know, thinking that they were right and torturing these Tibetan prisoners and what have you, that all he could think about was all the horrible suffering that these guards were going to have to experience in the future. You know, and again, that's how we would probably experience that type of situation. We would be much more concerned about our own suffering, much more concerned about what was happening to our bodies and our minds in the process of being beaten and tortured. But I'm assuming that based on, you know, what Dr. Chodok was saying at that time when, you know, I don't know again where Joseph Goldstein got all this information, but the idea of trying to work with an understanding of karma to really generate compassion towards his tormentors is really quite revolutionary. But is, you know, in some way what we need to begin to do. And one of the important things about this whole idea of karma and, you know, beings creating karma and then having to experience their suffering, the suffering that arises from their actions, is to make sure that we're not framing it in terms of kind of cosmic revenge. You know, and there's this idea in the West of, oh, well, they'll get theirs eventually. Well, this isn't such a helpful mind. I mean, because what is it? It's lacking, you know, any sense of compassion for the fact that beings are really under the control of these states of mind. We often use this phrase, you know, in Buddhism, being under the control of karma and afflictions. And what it means is that without a real knowledge and an ability to understand how to work with it, that is what's in the driver's seat. The, you know, habitual afflictions that we have, our tendencies towards having an angry mind and a desirous mind and so on, rather than some control over our mind. So once we learn through the Buddha's teachings to control our mind, then we have an opportunity to actually delay or, you know, cause some of our suffering not to occur at all. And we can, you know, reframe every situation so that we create the causes for happiness rather than suffering. So it's really important that we don't lose our heart connection to others in that way, to think that somehow they have, you know, an ability to control their minds somehow that we can tell from our own lives that we lack as well. You know, and try to open our hearts to the commonality of our situation, to see them just like us. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has a quote that Joseph Goldstein put in here as well that I think is quite nice. He says, "Your enemies may disagree with you. They may be harming you. But in another aspect, they are still human beings just like you. They also have the right not to suffer and to find happiness. If your empathy can extend out like that, it is unbiased, genuine compassion." So this idea of kind of seeing them, first of all, as being under the control of their karma and afflictions just like you is an important step. His Holiness points to another thing, to see that they're just like you in simply wanting happiness and wanting to be free from suffering. The reason why that person is maybe angry at you for something that you didn't do that they think that you did is because that situation has upset their happiness, has upset their peace of mind. So at some level, they're really just doing their best to try to find some measure of happiness and to not suffer, to not have difficulty in their life. But like most of us, they're quite misguided as to how to do that. So at some level, when we recognize that they are simply just like us in being, you know, under the control of karma and afflictions, just like us in simply wanting happiness, wanting to be free from suffering. And then we can even go a little bit further in terms of this Mahayana path that we're studying here, you know, trying to practice in Tibetan Buddhism. We can see that this being, whoever it is, our tormentor, our enemy, also has Buddha nature. Now, in Mahayana Buddhism, this concept of Buddha nature basically means that that being has the potential to become fully enlightened. That being has the potential to be a Buddha. And so at some level, although their minds might be quite clouded with all the afflictions and all the karma that they've created, and it doesn't look like an enlightened being in front of us, the core, the essence of an enlightened being is there. With the proper instruction and practice and so on, enlightenment can be achieved. So at some level, we should have an openness to, you know, who that being is and try to reframe how we're seeing them through this second point, you know, to not just see our enemies as something really different than ourselves, but to see them just like us in all these ways, under the control of karma and afflictions, wanting happiness, not wanting to suffer, and also having the potential to achieve true happiness through their Buddha nature. So in that way, we can kind of hold them as equals much more than, you know, someone who is less than us. And that kind of segues into the third point, which is we must let go of feelings of pride. Oops. And self-importance. So pride and self-importance, these are kind of oftentimes almost equivalent terms, but what we see is that this is what gets us into these attitudes of what we might call self-righteousness or self, another phrase that might be used is like self-aggrandizement, which is, you know, kind of our exaggerating our own importance in the situation. You know, so when we have those minds that are very prideful, where we're taking such stock in ourselves and our position and our ground throughout all of this, that we can't even see the other person's point of view, this is obviously, you know, a deluded attitude that's going to make a difficult situation more difficult, going to make it even a greater conflict. You know, we see this in the world at large. And when we look at, for example, what happened with 9/11, all the events that occurred after that, we can say that there was a strong sense of some sort of self-importance of the American government and the American people to a great degree, thinking that what had happened to us was unthinkable and inexcusable and had to be immediately, you know, taken care of in terms of some sort of corrective action that would try to get at the people who were responsible. And this was sort of what was driving people at the time. There wasn't an understanding of, oh, we must have wronged these people, let's take a look at what they're about and try to understand them and try to figure out how we can live peacefully and harmoniously in the world with them. There was really much more of a sense of they're much inferior to us and we've got to find a way to reestablish our superiority over them. And so we can see these minds at play. You know, and again, that's my assessment of what happened. There's obviously other people who would have a different assessment, but I think at some level we can look at even our own individual situations. Again, going back to these one-on-one things that happen in our work situation or in our family lives, where oftentimes this very prideful, sense of I know I'm right, and I know I'm more knowledgeable than you. I know I'm better than you, and therefore, you know, you just have to shape up or ship out kind of attitude. This is really, you know, a major obstacle to having any sort of resolution to any conflict. And it's not that we want to cultivate some false sense of humility in this. It has to be genuine. We have to be willing to kind of see eye to eye with the people who we're in conflict with. Kind of let go of that tendency towards these feelings of superiority and so on. And it's interesting, Joseph Goldstein mentions that this doctor, Dr. Chodok, says that actually this was the attitude that he attributes his survival in prison to. Because, you know, he could have very easily been killed. You know, many people have been killed in Tibetan, in prisons in Tibet that are run by the Chinese. But he said that because he was able to kind of reduce his pride and just allow everything to happen in a way that, you know, again, sort of allowed it to play itself out, and he was able to make use of the situation in such a different way. Because of that, he survived. Because of that, he wasn't tortured worse to the point of death and so on. So I think at some level we can, acknowledge that. Now, we aren't in situations where we're challenged in that way of having somebody daily beat us, torture us, and having to work with it. But in spite of that, it's interesting to at least spend a little bit of time taking a look at the Mahayana perspective in terms of how do we actually accomplish our self-interest. You know, because at some level, we're not talking about completely putting aside your self-interest. When we say to diminish your self-importance and your, you know, pride, does that mean that you have absolutely no sense of you and your needs and so on? I think that that would be a mistaken idea. But when we get to the Mahayana, we actually find that, you know, many of the teachings speak to the fact that if we really want to accomplish our own interest, how do we best do that? By being focused on others. There's a wonderful quote from Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. This is used quite frequently by the Dalai Lama and many other teachers in the Mahayana tradition. This is in chapter 8, verse 129. It says, "Whatever joy there is in this world, all comes from desiring others to be happy. And whatever suffering there is in this world, all comes from desiring myself to be happy." This is why His Holiness, whenever he teaches on this subject of kind of how do we go about really achieving our own happiness, says that we should actually be focused on others' happiness. When we are focused on others' happiness, this becomes the cause actually for our own happiness. He often calls this kind of being wisely selfish. And the idea being that we acknowledge that we all have some selfish tendency, some self-interest. You know, we're quite happy to, you know, forego some of our comforts and so on, but at some level we do need some satisfaction. Well, if we're going to do that wisely, His Holiness says we shouldn't be focused on just me and my happiness and all the things that are important to me. If we actually have our focus on others, that this can become the cause and actually is the main cause for our own happiness. It's a challenging one, I think, to work with, but this is really one of the fundamental principles of this Mahayana tradition, is to begin to let go of what we call sort of our self-centeredness or self-cherishing. It's very much this prideful attitude of looking at ourselves and thinking that somehow my happiness is more important than others. And once we start turning that around and we start thinking that others' happiness is so much more important than mine, it doesn't mean that you're negating your own self-interest or your own happiness. You're actually being much more skillful in achieving that. And to some extent, we can see that this is true. If we look at people, you know, like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, His Holiness, Mother Teresa, people who've spent their lives more or less focused on caring for others, helping others, being of service to others. You know, they're not really bitter, nasty people. They're really quite joyful and, you know, people that seem to have a lot more, you know, ongoing day-by-day happiness than most people that we know. So where is their happiness coming from? You know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama doesn't have 10 homes all around, you know, vacation homes all around the world with, you know, pools at every one and nice, you know, limos everywhere he goes. And, you know, sometimes he's treated that way when he comes to various places by the people hosting him. But he doesn't own any of these sorts of things at all. And he's quite simple in terms of his needs. So he's obviously not getting satisfaction in those ways that most beings look to. So he must be getting some level of satisfaction by being of service to others. And so at some, you know, some way we can look at that and really admit to the truth of that way that His Holiness talks about being wisely selfish, that if we are focused on others, we will truly meet our own needs. So the last point that this doctor makes that kind of gets into something we've already touched on, and this is probably most of what I'm going to spend the rest of tonight talking about, because I think it brings up the most challenges in terms of how do we actually work with making this a reality. Not that these aren't challenging enough. I think these are pretty difficult to work with. But number four is the idea of, and again, I'm sort of paraphrasing a little bit here, we must realize that hatred, because this is the one in particular that gets us into trouble. Obviously, a lot of our afflictions are problematic, but hatred is really the one when we want to maintain a peaceful mind that is probably our primary enemy at that time. The idea here is that hatred never ceases through hatred. It ceases only in response to love. So the classic antidote that is set out whenever we talk about kind of the afflictions that arise in our mind, the affliction of hatred, where we have a really strong dislike towards somebody, you know, where we are basically wishing them harm, wishing that bad things happen to them, that they don't have happiness and so on. The classic antidote that's set out in Buddhism is love. Now, this isn't like Buddhism has a monopoly on this idea. This is a common religious idea. Many spiritual traditions talk about trying to overcome hatred through love and the importance of that. At the same time, you know, this also is a difficult thing to practice. And if we look at the world around us, oftentimes even some religious or spiritual organizations might tend to still fall on the side of violence and other responses being appropriate. Whereas, you know, if we truly follow this, the only thing that is appropriate, the only thing that is a responsible way to deal with hatred is love. You know, if we truly care about the other person and their happiness, as well as our own, then hatred can never really be the response that makes any sense. So what we have to do to get this, and what we're going to be talking about tonight then through the rest of this, is how do we really get a good understanding of the disadvantages of hatred? How do we get a good understanding of the benefits of love so that we're encouraged to practice this? You know, and love kind of includes that whole body of, you know, compassion, kindness, all those sorts of attitudes. You know, hatred being the anger, hatred, any sort of aversion, thoughts of negative thoughts towards others. To some extent, we have to, you know, examine what we mean by these minds. And, you know, hatred, like I explained already, is really, you know, pretty obvious in terms of this strong feeling of wanting to harm somebody. Love, on the other hand, in Buddhism, is defined as the wish for another to have happiness and to have the causes of happiness. So when we're in confronting a situation where somebody is being really hateful towards us, and I'm again, you know, going back to the situation of this doctor where he was receiving sort of the hate and the anger of these prison guards, in terms of that, he saw that at that time the most beneficial thing for him to do was to practice a mind of love towards them. Now, what does it mean to say at that time that he wants them to have happiness and to have the causes of happiness? Does that mean that he wants them to, like, really enjoy beating him? You know, I think that would be, you know, mistaken. Because of an understanding of what really brings happiness, which is what we've talked about in these previous points, understanding that, for one thing, you know, in that situation, things can be reframed so that we can actually make it advantageous for both ourselves and others. That seeing somebody as an enemy isn't helpful, you know, rather to see how they really do crave true happiness, true peace. And then this idea of kind of letting go of any sort of pride that we might have so that we then see how can we become an instrument for helping someone else. So at the moment, what I'm guessing that this doctor was seeing is that he looked at it and he said, the best possible thing for me to do for my tormentor, for the prison guard who's beating me, is to develop more love and compassion for them. Why? Because in this way, by working on my own mind, I will be able to eventually be of greater benefit towards that person. Whereas, if the doctor were thinking to himself, well, why not just be equally hateful towards that person? Why not just respond to anger with anger? Then neither side benefits. At some level, you know, the only way for both sides to benefit is for that prisoner, the doctor, to use that time to actually cultivate a healthy motivation, a positive state of mind at that time, that will then create the causes to eventually improve their own mind to the point of enlightenment and then be able to be of greater benefit to that person who's their tormentor. Sounds like, you know, again, does require some understanding of what we're talking about in Buddhism. Most spiritual traditions wouldn't go this far with this whole concept, you know, because they don't have, a larger view of what it's all about. At some point, the captor, the person, or the captive, the person who is being imprisoned, this doctor has an ability to eventually help that tormentor. The connection that they're making kind of karmically in that, because he's generating this strong mind of love and compassion towards his captor, towards the person who's torturing him, will create the causes for when they do become enlightened, when the doctor does become enlightened, him to be able to help that being so much greater than what he could have if he generated a hateful mind. So it really comes down to analyzing it and saying, what is the most beneficial thing for me to do at the moment? You know, and the doctor from this Buddhist perspective said, the most beneficial thing for me right now is to be as loving and compassionate as I can. Now, we may not all be able to practice that way. Like I said, we're not all in that situation, thankfully, you know, of being tormented daily by somebody in prison somewhere. But we are dealing with our day-in, day-out challenges and difficulties. Going back to that original topic I talked about, we're getting hit by that first arrow in all sorts of different situations. How are we working with it to avoid that second arrow? The mental anguish, the torment that usually causes us to react then with anger, usually causes us to lash out, to, you know, be very defensive at that time. So it's a real simple analysis. It's like, what is most beneficial? What is most beneficial at this time for me to do? Is it more beneficial for me to get angry, or is it more beneficial for me to open up my heart and to really embrace the situation, the other being, what's going on, with an understanding of them being just like me, of acknowledging that they're under the control of their karma and afflictions, all these various, you know, things that we've already talked about. So this is, you know, at some level we see that, once again, most of what the Buddha is talking about is, if we're eventually going to create inner peace and pacify our minds, we have to work with reframing every situation, trying to make everything sort of grist for the mill and an opportunity to open up our hearts and to experience some benefit, so that instead of receiving that second arrow, we're actually receiving, you know, like a shower of flowers on us or something. We're only creating good in the process of encountering difficulty in our life. And this is really, I think, quite nicely laid out by this doctor as a formula for how we create inner peace. Now, this motivation of love and compassion that we need to have at that time is obviously very much related and sort of tied into this concept in Mahayana Buddhism that we have of bodhicitta. You know, bodhicitta, let me put this word up there. Have all of you seen this word before, bodhicitta? Yeah, kind of. Sometimes it's just spelled with a C here, but usually the H is added in just to emphasize this. Because sometimes in the Sanskrit the C is there, but it's pronounced with a ch sound. Bodhicitta is two words here. Bodhi, meaning awakening. It's the same root word as Buddha. A Buddha is someone who is fully awakened. Bodhi is the awakening. And citta is mind. So this is a mind of awakening. It's the mind that is sort of setting its sights on our full awakening, realizing our full potential. As I mentioned earlier, all beings having Buddha nature means that basically we can develop this aspiration, this wish, to completely actualize our Buddha nature, to become completely enlightened. But this mind isn't just about me becoming enlightened. It's motivated by being of benefit to others, by acknowledging that the best possible goal, kind of relating back to what we talked about earlier of kind of overcoming our tendency to cherish ourselves and our own needs, looking at it from the perspective of how will I best accomplish meeting the needs of everyone else, meeting the needs of all beings. The best way to do that is to become a Buddha, to become fully enlightened. So this mind of bodhicitta is very much, you know, in the Mahayana perspective, the most valuable and beneficial way that we can accomplish inner peace. So when all of this is sort of culled down into what is the common thread, the attitude that we should have at all times that will help us to develop inner peace, so that whatever situation we're confronted with, we make it into something valuable and useful for the path. This mind of bodhicitta seems to be, again, quite the core, the essence of our practice. So let's talk a little bit more about what this mind is and what we need to do with it. Obviously, if what our mind is doing has a strong impact on the results that we experience, then this mind, which is geared at our own enlightenment, has the effect of then producing those results. So our motivation of bodhicitta is really quite important in terms of making everything that we do around these various actions of how we confront distress and difficulty in our life into the cause for the greatest possible result. And that result being, again, our own enlightenment and then our ability to help others to become enlightened. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a whole lot of techniques, you know, two main sort of steps that we can go through, or processes we can go through, methods for developing this mind of enlightenment. I don't want to spend tonight kind of getting too much into those, but they're very much focused on a couple of key ideas. Obviously, compassion plays a big role in this. You know, the fact that once we begin to understand as was said earlier, this larger context of why is this person tormenting me? Why is this person doing things that are negative? Because of their own minds not being tamed, their own minds not being pacified. So once we begin to understand that, then we can generate this compassionate wish to help them to actually do that. Another key idea that's in here is recognizing the kindness and the connection to others. And this is a common principle, again, in many teachings in Buddhism, that we're all interconnected. There's an interdependence. There's no one who is kind of self-sustaining. You know, the clothes that we wear, the food that we have, everything that we experience is pretty much a product of what others have done, how others have contributed to our welfare. Particularly the beings who were very close to us in this life, like our parents and so on, that we owe a lot to in terms of their kindness. So these ideas of compassion and the kindness that others have shown us, the wish to repay that kindness, primarily through focusing on how do we best meet the needs of others? How do we, accomplish their welfare? So these are the common ideas that go through this mind of bodhicitta. But bodhicitta is really about trying to drive us to engage our lives in what we would call compassionate action, which is really a manifestation of the inner peace that comes when we begin to let go of our own importance, our own self-concern, and are driven by how do we most benefit others? How do we make them the object of what we're trying to accomplish in our lives? Rather than what we've been doing habitually since the day we were born, which is, how do I get everyone else to meet my needs? when we meet people, it's usually, well, we're not too interested in them unless they have something they can offer us, be it companionship, friendship, somebody who we can talk to, somebody who can get something for us, somebody who can help us in some way. At some level, this is how we go about living our lives, and we're not so interested unless people meet some of our needs. So at some point in this process, we need to turn the tables and become focused on others' needs. And in that way, we will actually be able to have some inner peace, because a lot of our conflict, again, the inner conflict comes from the opposite attitudes of all these four. When we basically don't see situations in anything but our own perspective, and we don't understand that other beings are just like us, and we don't, get the idea that they're there experiencing their own afflictions and so on. And we have this idea that somehow a hateful response is totally appropriate. We're in a society where this is embraced. So this mind of bodhicitta encompasses all of these ideas and really gets at, how we can be a source of relieving the suffering of others. So, any questions so far? I feel like I've been talking a lot. Probably have been. Questions so far before I kind of continue on this thread?
So, when he was being tortured, how did that translate to the torture that he was showing?
Mm-hmm. He doesn't go into it, but my feeling from other people that I, again, like Rigpa Rinpoche, who's spoken about his experiences and what have you, is that it often doesn't go through to the tormentor. And it may, but at the same time, they have such strong delusions themselves that are really hard to overcome, that it's not necessarily the point if they go through at that moment. Because what's happening at a deeper level in terms of the way that the prisoner is working with their mind and developing this compassionate connection to the other person is so much more relevant, because what that does is create the opportunity for the prisoner to get closer to enlightenment themselves. In the state of enlightenment, or even along the path to enlightenment, they will reconnect with that being through that strong karma. And this is one of the things, too, that is often pointed out in the Buddha's teachings, is that karma isn't just like, well, you are like bumper cars and you keep hitting all these other people and having these interactions, some of them fun, some of them not so fun, and you never run into them again. If you have a really strong karma where, you know, the guards that were tormenting these prisoners and the prisoners who were developing compassionate minds towards those guards, they're actually creating strong connections with those beings, and it will come to play in terms of future lives and them interacting with each other in quite positive ways, even in spite of the fact that they were being harmed by these guards. And it sounds kind of strange, because at some level, yes, the guards are going to have to experience, unfortunately, the results of all their negative actions of beating and torturing Tibetan monks and prisoners, you know, every day. Well, again, the fact that he did explain how this third attitude in particular he attributed to his survival there, I mean, at some level, maybe again because of his humility in the face of all this and his willingness to kind of just absorb and learn what he could in terms of working with this, again, the phrase that this greatness of heart that Joseph Goldstein used, to try to find that little nugget, that kernel of really valuable stuff in his own heart in the midst of being beaten by these, you know, guards and what have you. At some level, maybe again, there was some sort of subtle transformation that occurred that allowed him to be able to be freed from that situation eventually. But, you know, at some point in the process, we have to acknowledge, this is one of the reasons why we can really put some energy into becoming enlightened, is that in our unenlightened state, we barely have control over our own mind. And this is what this is all about, is really developing some control over our own mind, much less having control over somebody else's mind or what they're doing. The only way that we can help somebody in the long term is by working on our own mind, is by trying to learn how to control our own delusions so that we aren't creating more hatred in the world. We aren't being a part of that cycle of hatred where we are actually opening up to loving and compassionate thoughts towards others. And in that way, because that contributes to our progression towards enlightenment, once we attain enlightenment, we'll be in a much better position, they say, you know, to be able to help others. Why? Because as a Buddha, you're completely out of the quicksand. You know, there's this analogy of like we're all in this muck of the quicksand of the world of existence, and you can't depend on somebody who's in the quicksand to get you out, you know, because we're both in the quicksand. You know, who's going to help us get out? It has to be somebody outside of the quicksand, really. You know, somebody who can very skillfully help us in the ways that we need to in order to tame our own minds. And this is really what the Buddhas are all about. That's their job description, you know, enlighten all beings. So that's what they're going to do throughout now until there's no more beings to enlighten. So again, at the moment of the guard and the prisoner and the interaction that's going on there, the guard is having a very hateful mind, very angry mind. The prisoner is having a very compassionate, loving mind. It doesn't mean necessarily that the guard is going to change in that moment. And that's not why the prisoner is doing it. You know, the prisoner isn't, the prisoner would, you know, if you have a mind of love and compassion towards that being, you want nothing more than for them to stop what they're doing, you know, to actually learn to be loving and kind and compassionate themselves. But whether or not they do that is really up to their own minds and their own karma. And, you know, whether a guard would react in a, sometimes people actually, I've noticed from my own experience that when you're sometimes quite kind and compassionate, it might actually anger people more. You know? Yeah. 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 I mean, it's hard to say, though, because maybe at some point, you know, this is the reality, too, is that some people do learn by example. When they see, you know, that one prisoner, for example, because maybe there were many other prisoners who were getting quite angry and, you know, were being beaten to death because of their own fighting back in the process, but because he was willing to kind of take the blows and use it as an opportunity to go inside and work on his mind, maybe some of the guards actually were changed by that. You never know. But what reaction others have, again, isn't necessarily what we're investing in. You know, we're investing in the long-term effects of our working on our own mind. And this goes back to, once again, that what I said at the beginning, which is, you know, we will, as long as we live in a world where there are delusions, there will be wars, and there will be external things that upset our peace. So how do we work with them? Only by looking at inner peace. Because if we have inner peace, then it's not that we don't care that the world's at war. That's not the response that I'm talking about. If anything, you care even more, but you have more wisdom as to how to actually work with that. You know, to try to get out there and fix the external situation oftentimes is very futile, partly because we go into it with deluded minds. You know, look at what I was talking about earlier, how the U.S. went about trying to fix the whole thing after 9/11 with a deluded mind, thinking that they knew what was right to get back on top and in a superior position and put the people who were, you know, causing all this problem into a state of suffering and turmoil and what have you. So this is, you know, we're not so skillful when we get to manipulating the outside world. When we get to manipulating the inside world, we can be quite skillful once we learn how to do that, once we learn how to work with the mind. And this mind of bodhicitta is really quite invaluable in terms of when we have that motivation, when we think that my main purpose isn't to, you know, have lots of comfort in this life or to have, you know, goals that are external to myself. My goal is to work on my mind and develop my mind to its greatest possible potential. Then everything I encounter becomes grist for the mill. Everything I encounter becomes an opportunity to work with that and say, how can I make that into an opportunity to develop my inner peace, to have a truly pacified mind? So, other questions or comments before we... So I think the challenging thing about this mind of bodhicitta is the fact that it really is dealing with this concept of all beings, without exception. You know, how do we have a mind that is willing to be dedicated to relieving the suffering of all beings, without exception, every single one of them? You know, the goal of all of this is to certainly develop some sense of empathy for all beings, again, through some of these understandings, that they're all just like us, that they all have the same conditions. From that empathy, we can then develop, you know, a much more compassionate attitude, an attitude that really understands that their suffering, my suffering, same thing. Might look different at different times, but actually quite the same thing. You know, this idea of compassion, there's a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, who, again, next week there's the video about him. He has a quote that says, you know, compassion is a verb. And we oftentimes think that it's some sort of product, but it's the process. It's what are we doing with our minds? How are we thinking and engaging our minds? Joseph Goldstein describes this. He says, actively engaging with the suffering in the world and responding to the various needs of beings in whatever ways are possible and whatever ways are appropriate. So, this is how we get from kind of this compassionate action, because I don't want you to think from what we're talking about tonight that then bodhicitta means just kind of sitting back in your own little bubble, that, you know, the world's just kind of bouncing off of you and doing all these things and you're just in this bliss of, oh, I'm just wishing the world happiness and, you know, freedom from suffering. And it actually means being actively engaged in doing that, in being a part of the world and doing your best to serve the needs of others, with the recognition that we aren't in a state where we can do that ideally yet. And this is what I was talking about earlier, that we don't really have all the abilities because we're not out of the quicksand yet. The field of sentient beings that we're working in, where we're trying to develop compassion in whatever situation we're in, we see has some obstacles. And one of them is, you know, quite clear here in terms of hatred. You know, hatred can arise so easily, particularly in those times when people are harming us. There can also be a lot of fear, you know, and how do we work with fear and hatred? How do we overcome those resistance, the resistance that those give us to opening up to the suffering of others, opening up and becoming more expansive in our compassion, which is the source of this mind of bodhicitta. I think what's important, and Joseph Goldstein kind of points this out in his little essay, that you know, we have to really think, well, what is our wish at those times when others are encountering us with, you know, or throwing at us all of their hateful, angry energy? You know, when the world is being really difficult to us, what is our most sincere wish at that point? You know, if we follow this mind of hatred as it's set out in number four here, if we, you know, that first part of like thinking that somehow my hatred and anger back at that person who's being hateful and angry to me is going to solve the problem, you know, then this is, you know, a bit mistaken. But if we have the wish at that time, if we actually generate the thought of that being or that, you know, group of beings or whatever being free of hatred, you know, to have the thought, you know, may all beings not be deluded by this affliction of hatred, that this is really the ideal solution to all of it. You know, at some point when we begin to engage with the world as trying to be a source of diminishing hatred in the world, you know, and this comes from a couple of things. First, you know, really understanding that these feelings exist and, you know, being quite aware of them and that we have them ourselves. You know, that all of us have the seeds of hatred within us. But then seeing that in reality, these are really just the source of suffering. You know, so the fact that hatred never ceases hatred, this is speaking to the fact that hatred is a chain of suffering. You know, when we are hateful towards somebody who's hateful to us, it causes us suffering, them suffering, and it continues to perpetuate. Look at these situations that have been going on for decades and centuries in various parts of the world where you have groups of people who share a boundary that, you know, is in conflict and, you know, constant battles and people being killed and bombs and everything else because people think that somehow their hateful response towards hatred directed at them is going to solve the problem. And it only perpetuates the problem. So when we have somebody who we see being hateful towards us, we have to understand that although we have the seeds of hatred in us that are very prone to come up, they're only the source of our suffering and only the source of the other person's suffering. By being, you know, if this doctor had continued to be hateful towards those guards that were inflicting hatred on him, it only perpetuates their little ping-pong game of, you know, I hurt you, you hurt me, I hurt you, you hurt me, and doesn't really ever stop it. And again, we can't judge that by whether it stops in this lifetime or not. We have to judge it on a longer term as to whether we're creating the causes for these things to eventually cease in ourselves, and then we can help them, you know, to cease in others. You know, so no action that we engage in based on hatred is ever going to lead to our desired result. You know, if we really want hatred to end, we have to find the proper way to do it. With an understanding that hatred doesn't create the results that we want, nor the results that the other person wants, our only thought at the time when we're being harmed should be one of love and concern and a sincere wish that they be free of hatred, that I be free of hatred, that we all, you know, never have to experience that. You know, and our desired result of having kind of inner peace and peace in the world won't be accomplished if we perpetuate feelings of hatred. It's been proven time and time again. Look back, you know, we might say, well, oh, you know, when all these various battles ended, well, then there was some form of what we'd call peace. But was it a lasting peace? Was it peace that could really endure? Or did it simply lead to more delusions eventually and new forms of power and new conflicts and new things coming up? We have to use some wisdom in terms of how we're approaching difficult situations in the world and in our lives. So I think to some extent we have to check our own experience and be really honest with ourselves as to what we have found that will actually create peace in the world and peace in our own lives. And then if we find that what we've been doing hasn't been doing it, perhaps looking at these thoughts and trying to subscribe to this will give us some idea. of a better way to approach it, the Buddha's way to approach how we develop peace in our minds, peace in the world around us. To some extent, again, recognizing that until everyone is doing this, there's not going to be peace outside of us. As I was saying earlier, I think this is a bit of a dream that we have a romanticized idea of what peace could be. And I think it's great to have peaceful thoughts, to have this concept of how wonderful it would be if there was peace in the world. I remember getting a Christmas card when I was quite young, and it was that, I think there's a song that's, "Let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me." This is really what a whole lot of this is about, is kind of like, where does peace out there start? Peace out there starts when I'm more peaceful, when I have a mind that isn't getting hateful towards others. So in this way, with what I've talked about tonight, I think we can see that this is really what we mean by practice. To really work with our minds all the time so that we can bring some of these thoughts to mind when we're confronting whatever difficulty is unsettling us, creating us to have not such a peaceful mind, and find some inner peace in the moment. Joseph Goldstein, being in this tradition of insight meditation, they often use these, what they call metta practices. Metta is the Pali word, same word as Maitri in Sanskrit. It basically means loving kindness. And how do we generate those thoughts? And I'd like to share this with you because I think it's really quite valuable. This is maybe a little bit to think about and to kind of carry around in your head. But if at that moment when someone is confronting you in a negative way, or you hear something on the news about a politician that you don't like and you don't like what they're doing or what have you, and the normal response is to wish them nothing but suffering, and you want to open up to kind of wishing them love, to have this practice of loving kindness, that where you can begin by doing this for yourself. At that moment where you're being challenged, to have these thoughts, he uses the simple phrases of, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be free from suffering. And just give yourself those kind of warm thoughts, send them at yourself first. In all traditions of Buddhism, they basically say that all these sort of nice things we want to do to change our mind, to have a better attitude towards others, we have to first have that attitude towards ourselves. To understand our own suffering. That in that moment when somebody is causing us difficulty, that is not so pleasant. That is not so easy to deal with. And generate this thought of loving kindness towards ourselves. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be free from suffering. Then the directions are usually kind of, extend that out to someone, but don't immediately, go right for your enemy. It's going to be challenging enough, trying to generate these thoughts initially. So find someone who you find it quite easy to do that for, what we would call a friend or a benefactor, somebody who's benefited you greatly. And send the thoughts out that way, think about them. Because it'll become much easier, certainly, than your enemies. Because people have been kind to you in this life, done things for you, and so on. Then you do that kind of, may you be happy, be peaceful, be free of suffering. And you direct those thoughts towards those people and begin to open your heart to their well-being. And eventually, when you get to the point where you feel like you're quite well-versed in this thought and being able to be with that, with friends and so on, then you can start to engage in it with the difficult people. Try to embrace it for all beings. And the difficult people may still be a challenge. But if we have those thoughts at that time, what does it mean, again, to wish for our enemies to have happiness? As I said earlier, I don't think that if this doctor was thinking these thoughts towards his tormentors, he wasn't wishing for them to be happy that they were tormenting him. He was wishing for them to have true happiness, true peace of mind, the same thing that the doctor himself was working on achieving himself, which was an ability to have an open heart in the face of whatever is going on, to have that inner peace that is true happiness, as the Buddha said in that quote that I quoted earlier, that the real happiness is peace. So, again, I would encourage you to work with whatever thoughts that you find are beneficial to bring to mind. Jeffrey Hopkins, who's quite accomplished Tibetan Buddhist practitioner and scholar, talks about how he used these thoughts and how he really found that it began to change all of his experiences wherever he went. You know, having worked on them initially with himself and with those people quite dear to him, if he started seeing all beings in that light, then, you know, his heart was open all the time. And I think that this is a little fearful for us to think, you know, that our heart's going to be that wide open to the world. But how else are we going to start to feel connected to everyone? How else are we going to generate this mind that really wants to benefit all beings? Unless we can begin to let down our guard and open up our hearts a bit more. You know, he said that the people sitting next to him on the plane, he would have this attitude towards, and the people in cars going by on the freeway, he would, you know, try to generate this attitude towards. So we can extend it out to all beings eventually. And in this way, we can have a much more peaceful attitude. We can send it out to the guys in their car and what have you. So I think that's pretty much all I had to say tonight. Were there any questions before I close? I do want to do another quote from the Dalai Lama to kind of close things, but does this make some sense? Yeah, okay. Because when I read these, I was really quite taken with it. That's one reason why I wanted to, you know, kind of share all this in terms of this talk. I think we have these amazing examples in some of these Tibetan practitioners, like the story of this doctor that Joseph Goldstein shared, Venerable Rinpoche Rinpoche, many others who've left Tibet. His Holiness in Dharamsala, when he's there, he greets the Tibetan refugees that come over the border, and the stories he hears, I'm sure, must be enough to make you really openly weep for the suffering that goes on in the case of the Tibetan people. But, you know, suffering is everywhere. And I think, you know, we all have the opportunity, wherever we're at in our lives, to open up to that experience and to use it as an opportunity to, again, where is the greatest benefit going to be derived? If we develop a more peaceful mind, a more loving, compassionate mind ourselves, it will invariably affect the world, you know, at some point in the future. Won't have necessarily an immediate effect. I think this is one thing we have to let go of, is this idea that what I do with my mind right now is going to have an instant result in terms of the situation. You know, the first arrow is still going to be there, and we may have to keep experiencing it, but how we deal with whether or not we create the second arrow is really up to us. So His Holiness says, Joseph Goldstein says, he goes to the heart of things in the most simple and down-to-earth way. This is quoting His Holiness. He says, we are visitors on this planet. We are here for 90, 100 years at most. During that period, we must try to do something good, something useful with our lives. Try to be at peace with yourself and help others to share that peace. If you contribute to other people's happiness, you will find the true goal, the true meaning in life. So, with that, then maybe we can just have a little bit of a thought of dedicating what we've done here tonight. So, just reconnecting with the thoughts we had at the beginning of this session. You know, thinking that we were going to come together and spend a little bit of time talking about this subject of developing the peaceful heart so that we could have that ourselves, but moreover, so that we could help others to have that. So now think very strongly, kind of dedicating whatever positive energy we've created through discussing this topic, hearing what some of these other great beings like His Holiness and so on say about this subject, that this will become the cause for all beings to experience the peaceful heart, to have a mind full of compassion and love towards all beings, for all beings, ourselves included, to become fully enlightened. Okay. Thank you all very much.